They're making a list, they're checking it twice. They're gonna find out who's naughty or nice. The SIU is watching you now. They know who you've been sleeping with. They know if you're of age. They know if you've been gay or straight. So be straight, for goodness sake. You'd better watch out. You better be sly. You better keep out. I'm telling you why. The SIU is watching you now. This wall was not here. This wall was not here. This is all wide open space. And there was a raised area in the back, and there was a stairway going up to there. So this is looking down into this space, and you'll see there's little funny little wooden tables and funny little cloth-covered lights. Those lights were left over from Sanpaca's restaurant. So basically, when they cleared out, they left all their dishes and their tables and their light coverings and everything. And then this space.
So there was another floor, you're saying?
Well, it was about this high.
Oh, okay.
And it was open.
Okay.
To the back. So that was used as a stage. So when it wasn't being used as a stage, it was just another social area. You'd walk up the stairs, which were about there, and go up to the bar, and you could stand or sit up here, or you'd come down here or around the corner. And around the corner down there was particularly popular with a lot of women. But it could also be used for drag shows and talent shows and stuff like that. And this is a view that towards that corner, which gives you an idea about how open it was.
Robin Metcalf shepherded a dozen people around what is today the Khyber, but, circa the 1970s, was Halifax's only gay bar, the Turret. Metcalf carries a small netbook which contains a slideshow of pictures from the time. The onlookers stare vacantly at walls, trying to imagine throngs of dancing men and women, most of whom could have lost their jobs if anyone knew they were there. The group had migrated down the block from Venus Envy, where Canadian sociologist Gary Kinsman had spoken. Standing in front of the small crowd, Kinsman read excerpts from his book, The Canadian War on Queers. The book revolves around the national security campaign led by the RCMP, CSIS, and the Special Investigations Unit that targeted queer men and women.
We should probably kill the
music.
Okay, well, thanks, Mary, for the introduction. And I want to really thank Venus Envy for allowing us to use this space tonight and for providing this venue for this book launch. Our Ottawa book launch for the Canadian War on Queers was held at the Venus Envy store in Ottawa, which is, interestingly enough, one floor down from where the Gays of Ottawa office used to be in Ottawa. When we were discussing having the book launch at Venus Envy in Ottawa, my co-author, Patricia Zinchile, said, okay, I'm all right with having it at Venus Envy, but I will not speak in front of the dildo. But she ended up having to speak in front of the dildo. I'm sorry that maybe I'm not doing that, but I mean, I'm in front of other stuff here that probably has sort of some similar connotation. So I'm really pleased that Venus Envy has provided us with this space for tonight. I'm also really pleased to be doing a book launch specifically in Halifax and in Nova Scotia. Because I lived here in the early 1990s and was involved in AIDS and gay activism at that point in time. So I think it's really important for me to be doing an event like this. I'm also really excited about this event because I hope that it also provides a way for people to reconnect with some of the histories of activism and organizing here in Halifax. Now, just a brief overview of the Canadian War on Queers. It starts in 1958 in the Canadian context in a major way and continues, officially speaking, into the 1990s. It's also important to point out that to this day, CSIS can deny someone a security clearance if they have something to hide. So closeted queer people, closeted lesbians and gay men can still be denied employment in the federal civil service if they're deemed by CSIS to have something to hide and therefore they are national security risks. They won't get their security clearance level and therefore they will lose their job. Now, during the Canadian War on Queers, we were characterized as suffering from a character weakness that made us vulnerable to compromise by evil Soviet agents. Okay, that may not be somewhat sarcastic here, but that was the basic position. Homosexuals suffered from a character weakness. We had a sort of lack of moral fiber. We were untrustworthy. Homosexuality in some ways raised all sorts of troubling moral issues. And therefore, because we had something to hide, we could actually be blackmailed by agents of the Soviet Union or the Eastern Bloc. Should be pointed out that there's absolutely no evidence in the Canadian context at all that anyone was ever blackmailed successfully by agents of the Soviet Union. No national security information was ever divulged. But it's very clear from the people we talked to, because we talked to lots of people who were directly impacted by the national security campaigns, that they felt they were blackmailed by the RCMP, or basically blackmailed into giving the names and identities of their lesbian and gay friends, their queer friends, to the RCMP. So the real blackmailers that we talk about in the Canadian War on Queers is the RCMP and the National Security Police. Now, during the Canadian War on Queers, thousands of people were put under surveillance, thousands of people were watched, people's places were broken into, people's phones were wiretapped, people were followed, some people were interrogated over and over again for many years. In the early 1960s in Ottawa, there was a mini exodus of queer men in particular once these national security campaigns started. Some people left the country as a result of these national security campaigns. Some people ended up taking their own lives in the context of these national security campaigns. So they had a major impact. They destroyed people's lives. They destroyed people's careers. And to this day, there has been no official apology on the part of the Canadian state for these crimes. And there has been no compensation provided to anyone aside from Michelle Douglas and a few other individuals who waged legal struggles with the military in the early 1990s. So one of the things that we call for in the book is an actual real apology and a real policy of compensation for the wrong that was done to people in their everyday lives, the destruction of lives, the destruction of people's careers. Now, one of the things we document in the Canadian War on Queers is the campaigns that took place in a number of places across the country, but there's an awful lot of information about what took place in Halifax, especially given the military character of Halifax, the naval character of Halifax. There was an awful lot of military surveillance and also RCMP surveillance that was going on here. So just to give you one of the examples of the national security campaigns that people often ask questions about is the fruit machine. I'm sure most people in the room have probably heard this expression at some point, that there was this thing called the fruit machine in the 1960s that the Canadian government tried to develop. What the security panel tried to do was to develop a foolproof scientific way of determining who was queer and who wasn't, and those people who were going to be determined to be queer would then either lose their jobs or would not be hired within the civil service or the military. They contracted Professor Wake of the psychology department at Carleton University to develop this detection technology, which raises some very interesting questions about the interrelationships between universities and national security campaigns, which we should continue to investigate in our historical present as well. The central focus of the fruit machine research, I should point out, the fruit machine was not what Professor Wake called it. The fruit machine was the term that the RCMP officers gave to this piece of research, because they were supposed to be the normal control group that was going to be recruited to be tested on this detection technology. And they were desperately afraid that they would be recruited as normals but would be found out to be fruits as a result of this particular form of research. So they were the ones who gave it the name, the fruit machine. Central to the fruit machine research was a pupillary response test. Okay, so they would take photographs of the pupils of your eye at half-second intervals at the same time as they showed you semi-naked pictures, sometimes taken from physique magazines, of men and women's bodies. Okay, and if it got bigger, it dilated more, that was supposed to indicate that you were like really interested in this particular type of image. So central to this research was this pupillary response test. Of course, it never worked, it never could work. It was based on totally flawed assumptions. But the Canadian government and Health and Welfare Canada spent tens of thousands of dollars on this between 1963 and 1968, when the research was basically ended. Now, one aspect of the fruit machine research, because it was a battery of tests, was the development of a word association test. And what they would do is give someone the Palmer sweat test, which was basically holding something in your palm that would detect whether you were perspiring or sort of nervous or anxious about the words that were being read to you. And then they would read you a whole bunch of words, including words that they felt were homosexually coded. And if you expressed some sort of anxious response to these homosexually coded words, they would, that was one of the possible indicators that you might actually be queer. So they declared that words with definite homosexual meaning included the following. Okay? And please do not have any nervous, anxious responses in case there might be an RCMP or CSIS agent in the room. Okay, so the words were the following that were supposedly homosexually coded. Queen, circus, gay, imagine that, bell, hole, blind, bull, camp, coup, cruise, imagine that, drag, dyke, imagine that word, right? Fish, flute, root, mother, punk, queer, imagine that word too, rim, sew, swing, trade, velvet, wolf, blackmail, prowl, bar, you know, bar itself, eh? House, you know, house, club, restaurant, you know, restaurant, tea room, and top men. Now, if you actually look at the Queen's vernacular or other pieces of writing from this period of time of the types of words that were used among gay men in particular, you'll find that all of these words actually have some particular type of double meaning or double entendre when used in gay and queer circles at this point in time. So clearly they were drawing upon some information and resources coming out of homosexual communities. What's also really interesting, and I don't have time to go into this, is they also have a list of normal or heterosexual or neutral words, right? And those are also really fascinating to look at. Now, clearly this is somewhat absurd, right? And I'm obviously raising this because of its sort of comic relief value. But this was also part of the fruit machine research that was engaged in during this period of time. Now, the heart of the Canadian War on Queers is the first-hand accounts that we include in the book, and we include pretty long extracts from people's talks and narratives because we really want to give voice to people's experiences, and we don't want the book to simply be Patrizia and my voice as sort of the official monologue interpreting other people's experiences for the readers. One of those experiences comes from Frank Letourneau, who was purged from the Navy in Halifax in 1970. The story actually starts in the mid-1960s and culminates in 1970. Letourneau had a successful Navy career based in Halifax. In 65, he was promoted to lieutenant at the age of 23. This is what he has to say. The ship's second in command, my executive officer, asked me to come to his cabin and informed me that the military police wanted to see me the next day. When I asked why, he told me that I was suspected of being homosexual and that he and the ship's captain had been made aware of this. The next day, we drove up together to the military police office at Stadacona, and I was interviewed by relatively junior non-commissioned personnel. My executive officer offered to stay, but I told him, I'll be all right. Actually, I was anything but all right. As my interrogators began to flip through a thick binder containing pictures of my car in known cruising areas, details of my comings and goings, people I had befriended on board, ship, etc., the main focus of the question seemed to be to incite me to give them other names of serving gay personnel. Now, a particular target in the Canadian military has been lesbians, including in Nova Scotia, and I'm really pleased that Darl Wood is here with us tonight to talk about some of her experiences in terms of being purged from the military in the late 70s. That's your cue.
So, this, in a nutshell, is my not-so-brilliant military career. I've always had this love-hate relationship with the military. It was many things to me that, in the beginning, ranged from the love of the immediacy, the immediate intimacy between women, and the excitement, and oddly enough, it also kind of represented a kind of security in my life. But it also evoked revulsion, resistance, and extreme fear. over being founded out. I came out while I was posted at Stadacona Naval Base in the midst of the 1970s witch hunts. And this was a time when so much of the world was in flux. And thankfully, the women's movement and the lesbian and gay movements were at their strongest. So I consider myself very fortunate to have come out at this time. In May of 1978, I was called into the office of the military police commander and was asked point blank if I was homosexual. And that's, those are the terms, the medical terms that they used then. I had the unfortunate privilege of running the military police orderly room at the time, so it was a little dicey at any time, any given time. Anyways, I was taken kind of off balance when he called me into his office, and I was kind of stunned. So I wasn't able to think or even talk. It was like someone had taken a white hot knife to my heart. Shortly after that interview with him, I was shortly moved across the road to what they call the Special Investigations Unit for questioning. And I was held there for many, many hours until I gave them information that they wanted to know. Except, and this is where the resistance comes in for a lot of us, the refusal to name other women as being lesbian. There are still repercussions of what they actually took from me or stole from me that day. The 7 years of therapy later for post-traumatic stress, I realize now that it was an invasive and brutal sexual assault on me against myself and others. It also came down to the loss of everything that mattered to me in my life at that point. My lover, my career, my home, my self-esteem, physical and mental health, and also importantly, the military communion, our community of women that we developed at that time. So these things take many years to heal. In fact, I still have nightmares and abreaction. Lately, I've learned that it is also what others suffered with a lot of the same difficulties in coping in everyday life, even after 30 years. And I've talked to some of the women lately who have been in touch with me, thankfully, through the interview with the CBC, and women have gotten in touch with me, and we've been able to dialogue, and we've found out that we've all isolated, but we were all feeling and going through the same things. I'm actually in the middle of writing about it, and I thought that I would just... it's rather tacky, right? Rather tacky, reading from your own work at another book launch, but here again. I get this one. So bear with me. Blood pounded in my ears, blocking out most of what he was saying. Words flew inaudibly from his lips. My senses were being singed, and I heard little. Only little bits and pieces of words, even absorbed through my skin. I could feel the flesh of my face scorched from the inside, the saliva in my mouth dried, my stomach cramped, and I wanted to be sick, violently, irrepressibly sick. My hands felt dead to me as I sat rubbing them. There was an intense pause when the muffled voice ceased. Slowly my body began to cool. My temples throbbed, pounded until I barely heard my own voice whispering, "I don't know what you want." The last sentence permeated the confusion as the officer leaned forward, addressing me by my first name, gently, quietly, maybe even a touch reluctantly, "Are you homosexual?" I didn't answer. What was there to say? Looking down, I found a volume of the Queen's regulations and orders in my hands. I don't remember giving them. I stared at the book. There is nothing but a blur of aggressive words before me. I don't have to read what they are saying. I already know them by heart. It tells me I'm a deviant. Suitable, not suitable for being here. How many nights have I lain awake next to Marg, her naked body warm, smooth, comforting, considering what would happen if we were found out? No shame, no shame associated with my love. In our innocence, maybe wisdom, we agreed to admit it if we were somehow found it out. I still wonder now if we can hang on to each other, what we have. Now this is happening. It is so unexpectedly expected. I can't think clearly enough to reason what to do next. What can I say? I want to cry, pray, do something, anything to get me out of here. God, what do I do now? Do I confess to the crime of loving another woman? The major is distinctively uncomfortable. I want to crawl into a hole, die, anything not to have to face what was coming next. I knew from others, from police reports. Again, looking at my hands, they appear bloodless, the nails lilac. A shiver runs through me now. I know it is a cruel, relentless process. Everyone will know. My whole life opened up before the world to view. My friends, my co-workers, my family. Oh God, my family. Across the road, there was a special investigations unit building. Two men escort me there and tell me to wait. The room is small, with padded door, soundproof. It is empty except for a table and three chairs. The pale wooden ones with straight backs that make you sit upright and be very, very still. I sat with my hands clasped like a grade school girl, anticipating the blows she knows will be coming. I waited. Please just take the numbness away. I can't breathe, I whispered to the intangible deity, trying to draw strength from it. It didn't matter if it was real or imaginary. My mind, my thoughts, constantly were on Mark. One of the men asked if I wanted a woman present while being questioned. It's your right to have someone with you, a woman. This is the first time I become aware that someone has come back into the room. I want to spit the words back at them. No, I don't think so. Shame welling up in me. When did you first know you were a lesbian? They wanted to know. Two men interrogating me about my sex life. What? Can they ask that? They can, they could, and they do. And over and over until I felt my head spinning with them. I desperately need to challenge their right to do this, but I don't. Feeling helpless to do what? Anything. I've already told you I'm gay. It was fruitful. It was futile. Rather, a childish outburst of defense with no authority behind it. It wasn't enough to plead guilty. They wanted details, when, where, even how, tribadism, digital manipulation, on and on, repeatedly. And the same questions again and again until I feel I will scream, name it, not understanding half of what they asked or what they want from me. What did I do wrong? I must have done something, my fault. They explain terms. A warmth rushes through me, feeling dirty. I am going to be ill. I am ill. Is Sergeant Jameson the first woman you've had sex with? They want to know. A yes somehow escaped my mouth. Is she the only woman in the service you've been involved with? Yes, the only one. I've already told you that 100 times. They change the direction of their questioning abruptly. Do you know what cunnilingus is? Yes. I close my eyes and...
My name's Gary Kinsman. I'm the co-author of The Canadian War on Queers, National Security as Sexual Regulation. I'm also a longtime queer liberation and anti-capitalist activist.
Great. So maybe just give me your short experience of living as a queer in Canada and writing the book and some of the things you came across?
Certainly, you know, my life, I came out when I was 15, and things were pretty horrific then. And I mean, in some ways for young queer people, they continue to be quite horrific. I think many young queer people live in heterosexist regimes of terror to this day that needs to be addressed. But certainly for a lot of adult queer people, especially white and middle class people, things have gotten an awful lot better. There's been a lot of improvement. So there's been major changes I can see over the decades of my life. In terms of the book project, what we were trying to do, Patrizia Gentile, my co-author, and myself, we're basically trying to provide the first documentation, detailed documentation, of the national security campaigns against lesbians and gay men that started in 1958 and didn't really officially end until the 1990s. And we looked at two sources of information. One was the official documents that could be released from the RCMP and the Security Panel and later CSIS. And also we drew a lot upon the firsthand accounts of people who directly experienced the national security campaigns, people who were fired, were purged, who were detrimentally affected by the campaigns. And we used those experiences to critically interrogate the official story of the national security regime. I guess the most important thing that we discovered was, despite all of the careers and lives that were destroyed by this national security campaign, and despite the incredible need for the government to apologize and to compensate people for the wrong that was done to them, that we were most surprised by the resistance and non-cooperation that we discovered, that even in the 1960s, people were able to refuse to give the RCMP names, were able to refuse to cooperate, were able to engage in forms of resistance against the RCMP, which concretely obstructed and messed up what they were trying to do.
What was the process like of finding those people who were prosecuted by the RCMP and by CSIS and by the security agencies in general? And what was it like getting them to tell their stories?
Well, for me, it wasn't difficult because I'd already done a lot of oral histories and life histories with people about their experiences in the 50s and 60s. So those are the networks I started with, the people I'd already talked to. And it was pretty easy to find men. We were able to find less women who were directly affected, although more women in terms of being purged from the military. We certainly got a lot of their stories. So it wasn't that difficult to find people, and it wasn't that difficult to get people talking. As soon as it was sort of clear you were on their side and interested in hearing what they had to say, people were usually quite forthcoming. Obviously, as I'm sure you know, some interviews work better than others, but people were generally quite forthcoming. I think it helps that, you know, Patrizia is a lesbian, I'm a gay man, so when we're talking to people, we can identify with them in particular types of ways. There were types of interviews that were more disturbing, which is what we describe as interviewing the enemy, interviewing RCMP officers or government officials, and those were sometimes more troubling. And what we sort of would have to do is set aside our emotional political responses to what people were saying and focus instead on trying to learn from them how their work was actually put together, how it was done. So that was probably the more difficult interviews were those ones. And we had some interviews with people who were trained as lawyers that really didn't work at all, because clearly you could see their first response was to think of what are the legal implications of this question, and they would basically clam up. They couldn't tell us anything about the work they'd actually done.
So maybe just describe the range of the sort of stories you heard. I know you described some of them in the book, but I mean, I'm sure there were some that were somewhat benign, and there were some that were somewhat a lot more serious.
Yeah, I mean, there were people who fled Ottawa once these campaigns started. There were people who even left the country. There were people who took their own lives. There were people who decided not to have sex with other men for years and years and years because of these national security campaigns. There were people whose careers, they weren't purged, but basically their careers stopped. They were no longer possible for them to advance. But there were also some civil servants and some people even in the military who were able to avoid detection, who were able to refuse to give names, and were able to, you know, maintain themselves in those positions. It partly depended on the historical time period. In the civil service by the mid-1970s, usually you would get demoted, but you wouldn't get entirely purged from your position. So it partly depended on the situations. There's some people in the military who were able, through personal connections, to sort of avoid the more devastating aspects of the purge campaigns, but other people, you know, felt the full brunt of it. So there was a range of experiences. I would not actually say any of them were benign, but some were certainly a lot more severe and intense than others.
So maybe just talk really briefly about what sort of underground movements popped up because of this security persecution that existed, and what sort of ways did queers in the time find to resist security and find to kind of flourish despite it?
Okay, well, I mean, during the 1960s, when there was very little sort of official organized gay or lesbian movements, what I think we found was that a lot of people were part of gay and lesbian networks, and especially for those people who weren't in the civil service or the military, they were able to develop ways of talking, ways of strategizing. There was actually a gay RCMP officer in Ottawa who gave advice to people who weren't in the civil service or in the military or in the RCMP to basically, you know, you don't have to tell them anything. You're under no legal obligation to tell the RCMP the names of your friends. And that sort of got around, and people sort of developed this community ethics whereby, you know, we're not going to give names, and if people do give names, they're going to get shunned by their lesbian and gay friends. And that was a fairly successful non-cooperation strategy in the 60s. By the 1970s, you actually have movements of people, organizations that come under RCMP surveillance as well, but that provide a much more collective basis for resistance. And people begin by becoming more public and more visible to undermine some of the central arguments of the national security campaigns.
So how do you make this resistance more modern? So how do you update this sort of movement against heteronormative society to a modern day life where being gay is largely, to some extent, accepted, where the out population is somewhat significant, and where being gay has become somewhat taken by the heteronormative society and almost privatized in a way?
Well, I mean, I think there's a range of experiences here. I think a lot of young queer people still experience, you know, what I describe as a heterosexist regime of terror. The ideology of fag and dyke in quite profound ways in high schools and on city streets. There's still incredible forms of anti-queer violence that exist. And I think in some ways it depends on who you're talking about. For queer people living in poverty, for many queer people of color, for many trans people, there's still an awful lot of oppression, exclusion, and marginalization. But what I think you're getting at is that for some white middle-class gay men and a lesser number of lesbians, they've sort of been able to become an accepted part of the broader white middle class in our society. So they've sort of got benefits and rights out of our liberation movements that are still being denied to many other queer people. But I think there's also the question of where has the national security campaigns moved since the central targets were against queers? Well, they clearly moved against subversives more generally, as we saw at the policing of the G20 protests in Toronto last June, where basically global justice protesters get expelled from the fabric of the nation, just as queer people were earlier, and also in the so-called war on terror, where you see Arab and Muslim-identified individuals, including Arab and Muslim-identified queer people, being expelled from the fabric of the nation. And instead, a sort of white, you know, small C Christian-derived culture being put in place at the center. And I think what this means is that we have to recognize that national security, as we characterize it in the book, is always an ideological practice. It's always about excluding some people or expelling some people from the fabric of the nation and only including a smaller group of people, oftentimes, or a particular group of people at the center of the nation. So one major conclusion we draw from our research is there's a problem with national security itself. I was just at a conference in Montreal, and one of the things that we're trying to articulate is what would a sort of people's security or a popular security look like, where we actually begin to understand that it's the RCMP and CSIS and national security police that are actually threats to our own security, and how could we organize a different sort of notion of security?
Right. So how does the queer movement, being that middle class, being lower class, being racial minority, how do they push back and take on a new sort of queer identity in the same way that your generation pushed back and kind of reclaimed a certain notion of your own society?
Well, I mean, I think you actually see a lot of sort of young, radical, queer activists, and by radical, I mean getting to the root of the problem type activists. I think you see a lot of those young queer activists in groups like No One Is Illegal, in groups like the Ontario Coalition Against Poverty, in various different global justice and social justice activist movements. And it seems to me that those are going to be some of the crucial resources for reigniting or rebuilding a sort of radical queer liberation movement. I think them coming together with some of the more critical currents within more mainstream forms of gay and lesbian organizing. That's going to be the basis upon which we can rebuild our movements, because I think right now we don't really have either lesbian or gay liberation movements or queer liberation movements. I think we're at the point where there's various exciting possibilities happening all across the Canadian state, but they still really sort of need to be brought together. That we need to have those discussions about how we can reignite a radical queer liberation movement that's built in alliance with other oppressed and marginalized people.
In your book, you talk a lot about the persecution that those in the civil service especially face. So my question would be that where was the civil service unions in that time? Because I know right now a lot of unions, especially civil service unions, actually have a lot of sexual diversity programs. So what were they doing at the time?
Well, the unfortunate story around unions in Canada is that many of them were quite complicit in the campaign against communists in the union movement in the 50s and into the 60s. I mean, so there was a major form of complicity in some of the national security campaigns. Because of that, it was rather difficult for them to oppose the purge campaigns against lesbians and gay men. But that began to change in the 1970s, and it changed first in the Canadian Union of Postal Workers as it became more radical and militant, and as queer workers within the post office and other parts of the public service started to organize, they were able to bring about more significant and substantial changes within the union movement. So by the 1980s, the union movements actually become some of the most important allies of the lesbian and gay liberation movements. But if we go back to the 50s and 60s, the unions were not always on our side. Even if they might dispute some of the disciplinary measures that were enacted against workers, they were in some ways still complicit within the practices of national security. But we've seen a major transformation in the unions, and I think that's been really, really important. I think the self-organization of queer people within the union movement has been a very important part of the lesbian and gay liberation movements over the last couple of decades.
And is there any sort of other forms of organization that you think is fundamentally important, and not on just on a grand scale, but in terms of very, very specific local groups?
Well, I mean, part of the theme of our book is that how ruling often takes place is through the social organization of forgetting, and we're arguing that a necessary antidote is the resistance of remembering. So for us, activist history projects, grassroots activist history projects, there may be academics from universities involved in them, but activist grassroots history projects documenting our activism, documenting our histories so that we don't forget those histories of resistance and struggle are absolutely crucial. So that's one of the things I would encourage people to get involved in. If there is a activist history project in your city, in your community, in your neighborhood, in your movement, get involved in it. If not, maybe think about starting it.
I am Robin Metcalf, queer activist and community historian, and currently the director curator of St. Mary's University Art Gallery.
I'm James McSwain, and I'm a bon vivant of artistic exuberance in Halifax.
He's an old fag.
Yeah.
So what's it like participating in a queer society that needs to be underground, a queer society that's kind of suppressed? I mean, that's a lot what was talked about at the talk tonight. An entire society and a movement that's been pushed underground and pushed to being very secretive. What's it like participating in that? Do you have any experience in that?
Well, I would say actually, in a sense, no, because I was fortunate enough to come out at the moment when gay liberation was blossoming. So I came out immediately into a politicized and activist community, and my first gay community was in many ways an activist community, so I could be out. I went to my first conference in 1975 in June, and I came back from Ottawa with a pin that said "Gay Rights Now," big block letters on a yellow background. And I remember that people gay men I knew in Halifax would cross Spring Garden Road to get away from me so they wouldn't be seen in public with me, because the community was very closety. But I connected with the small number of people in the community who were out and were activists. I was 21, And fortunately, there was an out community. There was the beginnings of an activist community. So that was where I began to form my identity. So I didn't really experience... I experienced the tail end of it. I mean, I was at the transition point between that very, very closeted, secretive world and a world that was declaring itself openly. So I knew about that world, but I didn't really live in that more closeted world.
Well, I came to gay liberation through my artistic sort of, you know, being an artist. And so my liberation was sort of kind of both as a, you know, being able to sort of articulate myself through artistic kinds of performances and theatrical events and all the rest of it, rather than sort of like through activism. But by the time I was sort of, you know, like when I was, but you know, I came to GAE at the same time as Robin did as an activist. But I was sort of by that time I was you know. Sort of kind of being able to be liberated through artistic sort of exploration.
So Robin, you talked a lot about being in the politicized gay movement. We're in a kind of generation now where the gay movement has been largely co-opted by the general culture as a whole. Do you think there's a need to break out of that? And do you think there's a need to re-politicize being gay?
Yes, I think that there were a lot of radical questions that we were able to deal with, able to examine and question in the 1970s. I mean, an example of this is same-sex marriage. A lot of people will come, a lot of, you know, very nice middle-aged straight people come in to me and say, oh, and you must be so happy now that you can have same-sex marriage. And in the 1970s, I remember we wanted to abolish marriage. We thought that it was a property relationship and inherently oppressive. Now, that doesn't mean that I don't celebrate to some extent. I have friends who are overjoyed that they can get married. And of course, it's a good thing that people are treated equally under the law. But I come from a tradition where we question on a more radical and fundamental level the very structure of that law. And so there's some loss of that. It's harder now to ask, why do we have marriage as a legal contract? What are its origins? The whole idea of family, a family is a double-edged thing. On the one hand, there's a song called We Are Family, which I find very emotionally powerful, which is a song of solidarity among queer folk. On the other hand, family comes from a Latin word, which is the plural for its familia, is the plural for the word famulus, which means domestic servant or slave. So a familia is the children, wives, slaves, and cattle that belong to the paterfamilias, the father of the family. So family is not altogether, family is something you have to look at the history of. And the institutions associated with it, like marriage, etc., have problematic histories. And I find that it's difficult to raise that. Now, it's easier to raise that kind of point in the 1970s. Jim and I sometimes joke about we miss when being oppressed. because we miss being, you know, harassed by police or beaten up by queer bashers, but we miss the freedom that came from being truly counter, truly other, and being able to question a broad range of things. When you're included, it's harder to question fundamentals.
So if you could say, you know, one piece of advice to a young queer to propagate the queer movement, whether that's politically or creatively or another way, what would it be?
Well, one is know your history and don't take as written the what you've received. The earlier phases of whatever movement are much richer intellectually than often what you're told. The 1970s feminism, 1970s gay and lesbian liberation are full of multiple strands, including some quite radical and questioning ones, and they're part of a history that goes back to the 19th century, the 18th century, the 17th century. There's a lot more there than what we're told about. So we're part of a very, very long strand of resistance and questioning and analysis. I think knowing that history and not taking anything for granted.
Yeah. Don't take anything for granted. No, it's true. I mean, yeah. You know, like who? I mean, we live in a multi-pluralistic sort of, you know, ambiguous, paradoxical, contradictory society, constantly, and we're constantly sort of like trying to, fall in love with, you know, as many people as possible, and in this, in the, in that sense of you know, expanding the sort of, you know, like the world and the people that we live with.
Great, thanks so much.
Thank you. Yeah. I get the sense.